ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
So Priya, I've never met anybody who is so careful about what they provide to their children on the kitchen table. It's extraordinary.
Well, I actually get a lot of joy out of it, I have to say. I love making food fun. I take great joy. I know I'm alone in this and a lot of people are probably sighing, but I quite like packing a lunchbox.
Well, you're not alone in this. Your books have sold well on it. Clearly it meets the mark. What do you do about salt?
I'm very careful about salt intake because I know about the potential implications for kidney, for heart health. And Norman, when I share some social media videos cooking, doing my thing, a lot of people come for me when I say I'm not adding salt to this because there's enough in the canned tomatoes or the passata. People think I'm too rigid.
Do your children agree?
My son loves salt, but he knows why mummy's careful.
That's very good. That's coming up on this week's Health Report. Children and Salt.
I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri Land.
And I'm Norman Swan on Gadigal Land.
Also on the show, risk-based screening for breast cancer. Should women be screened differently according to their baseline risk?
It could mean that some women get more screening and a lot of women get less.
And we're going to chat about what is best practice for the diagnosis and treatment of endometriosis because you've likely seen a lot of stuff in your newsfeed.
Yeah, and on Four Corners. And what exactly is the role of laparoscopy?
In the news, Norman, there is more evidence about reducing the risk of dementia and potential cognitive training exercises.
This is a remarkable study. It's called the ACTIVE study, which stands for Advanced Cognitive Training for Independent and Vital Elderly. And it's been going on for at least 20 years. And it took nearly 3,000 people and divided them into four groups. There was a control group. There was a group that got memory training. There was reasoning training, which was about problem solving. And there was cognitive speed training, which was really about improving the speed of thinking. And a random sample of the four groups was offered booster training, in other words, top-ups about a year later, and then about 3 years later, and then followed up right about 8 to 10 years later, and now there's a follow-up at 20 years. One of the things about cognitive training is something called transfer. So a lot of people are doing Sudoku, thinking, well, that's going to help me with everything else in my life. Well, it turns out probably doesn't. So when you train on Sudoku, you become good at Sudoku. This wasn't Sudoku, but the issue is, do things transfer to other parts of your life? What they showed at the 8 to 10 year point, compared to the control group who had declined, the group who had had the interventions hadn't declined in terms of their age-related function for those particular things like memory, reasoning, and speed. And some of them had actually improved.
So you're saying the control group being they had no intervention done, and if you're in any of the other three arms, you either stayed the same or did better?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which meant that you were doing a lot better than the control group.
Than the control, yeah.
Because they declined. And it was particularly so in those who had been offered booster training. And there wasn't a lot of evidence, by the way, of transfer. So they were really just testing your memory, your reasoning power, and your cognitive speed. And that was a bit disappointing because they were hoping that it would spread to other functions in their life. And there was also a hint at that stage of delay in the onset or reduced onset of dementia, particularly Alzheimer's disease and related dementias. So that was really good news at 8 and 10 years, that even though there was no transfer, there was a sense that this might prevent dementia. At 20 years, only the cognitive speed benefit was maintained. So memory had lost the benefit, reasoning power had lost the benefit, but cognitive speed had maintained, those who'd had cognitive speed training, and they had significantly lower risk of developing dementia.
It's very interesting. I just want to know practically though, Norman, because I think a lot of people are listening going, so what am I meant to be doing, Norman? What is cognitive speed training? If it's not Sudoku, what is it?
So this is where, you know, buyer beware. So first of all, let me just give you the caveats for this trial. First of all, the people who stayed in the trial, who dropped out, about 44% dropped out, either because they died, because they were elderly to begin with, or they dropped out. The people who stayed on tended to be better educated and healthier, which means that they had a lower risk of dementia to start with. And they tried to allow for that. in the study. So it wasn't a perfect study, and it was only in people who had booster training at 1 year and 3 or 4 years. So what was the element of cognitive speed training?
Mm-hmm.
So if you are actually out shopping for cognitive training, you want cognitive training that's adaptive. That means it constantly pushes you. And that's what the cognitive speed training was.
So it's not crosswords, Sudoku, it's a bit more complicated.
It's formally designed program with evidence behind it, and it's adaptive. So the better and faster you got, the faster you were trained on the training. And it looks as though it works. And if it works, it's likely because what the speed training did was change the structure of the brain almost certainly, although they didn't do brain scanning to prove that, to make the brain more adaptive and resilient to change. So in other words, there was more reserve in the brain, even on top of their education and advantage in life that they came into the study with. It's the only study that's ever gone on this long, and it's one of the largest studies ever into cognitive training.
So this is awesome news that cognitive speed training might actually reduce your risk of dementia, but also all the things like moving the body, dietary factors, staying socially connected, combating loneliness, all of those things are really important too. Also in the news, and it wouldn't be the health report without something in the GLP-1 space, that's normally your line.
Yeah.
There is new research that's been published in The Lancet. We should acknowledge it has been funded by the drug company Eli Lilly.
And the reason we say that, when you look at a drug company funded trial, it's more likely to be positive for the drug company.
Yes, but we also need to acknowledge that a lot of research wouldn't happen without drug companies, but we should always acknowledge who's funding it. This has looked at oral GLP-1s, and it's compared one called orforglipron, which is a novel non-peptide GLP-1 receptor agonist. It's an oral version, you take it daily, and it's compared it to oral semaglutide. Now, people would know semaglutide, it might be ringing a bell. That's Ozempic, the injectable version. This is the oral version.
Or Wegovy. And the first one is actually the Eli Lilly product.
This is a randomised controlled trial. It's multi-centres, so across multiple sites. They've taken adults aged over 18 who have a history of type 2 diabetes that's not adequately controlled on metformin. Metformin is first line for type 2 diabetes, and that's how they've selected the people. And they've randomised them to either the newer orforglipron or semaglutide. And what they've found is that this newer medication is certainly not inferior but better than the oral semaglutide at managing type 2 diabetes. I think it's important to say, Norman, it's looked the primary outcome at diabetes control, not at weight regulation. So it certainly appears to be better in the diabetes space.
And the initial findings on the semaglutide on its own for weight loss is that it's not as effective as the injection, but it does help you to lose weight. But there's awkwardness about how you take it. I think you've got to take it at a certain time of day or night. I can't remember now exactly. And you've got to wait. You know, it's not going to be around food. There are all sorts of restrictions in how you actually take it to get its effect.
But the new one, this orforglipron, apparently there's no food or water restrictions, but more people discontinued that newer medication, the orforglipron, in the study because of gut side effects. So nothing's perfect, but, you know, I think a lot of people are interested in oral GLP-1s. Are they coming? What will it look like? And so an interesting space to watch.
You can guarantee us as the GLP-1 centre. And there's a fairly comprehensive study on food allergies and what are the risk factors for them.
This is a passion area of mine. And we know that food allergies are a growing health burden. We've covered a lot in this area recently around the introduction of solids and common allergy-causing foods. There's a study that's been published in JAMA Pediatrics which has really looked at risk factors. Which kids are most at risk of developing food allergies? A huge systematic review, meta-analysis. They've looked at 190 studies which had more than 2.9 million children involved in them, so big numbers. And some of them I think we know when it comes to the risk factors. We kind of know which kids are probably higher risk. They've got a family history of food allergy. They have eczema. But I was interested, Norman, some of the things that popped up, like infant having antibiotic exposure early in life or the mum having antibiotics when they were pregnant, and parental migration. So if your parents had migrated, you were higher risk.
Yeah. So that's microbiome. And it's fairly well known that when you migrate, you inherit the allergy response of the environment into which you move. You also inherit the risk of coronary heart disease, risk of other cancers and so on. So it's not necessarily a surprise. You might well develop a different microbiome, different feeding patterns and so on. And they also show that your risk goes down the more siblings you've got, which we knew already. So some of these are fairly small increased risks, but the big ones that we talk about all the time are the ones which really do seem to make a big difference.
And we've talked recently about the introduction of solids. Delaying the introduction of solid food is a risk factor. And so this is just a reminder to get those common allergy-causing foods in before the age of one, if you can, if there's no reaction, and to avoid food proteins on the skin. That's the other one.
And be careful of these products that people are advertising, suggesting that they're going to give you the allergens. You know, just use ordinary food.
And I think you can do everything, Norman. We need to be really acknowledge that some kids are just really high risk and you can do everything.
And they'll still get it.
They'll still get it. And it's not your fault. You're doing your best, but some kids are just really high risk.
On Radio National, you are listening to The Health Report. So now, Priya, we're going into your kitchen about salt in children's diet.
Yes, I think not that many people will be surprised to hear that a lot of kids are eating too much salt.
I'm shocked. I'm falling off my chair.
Well, the question is though, Norman, is it a bad thing? Does it have health impacts? And there's a recent study that's looked at how much salt kids are consuming, and it's actually looked at their 24-hour urine excretion of salt.
My God.
You're not relying on a dietary history, because goodness knows what my kids are eating day to day at school that I don't know about. So it's looking at their urinary excretion of salt, and has it had an impact on their blood pressure? The results are quite interesting.
So they're running around with a potty, are they?
I don't know. I didn't go into that level of detail. Yeah, are you disappointed?
Technique of these trials, I mean, can you imagine?
Well, to find out more, including some practical tips on how we can all work at reducing salt intake in our diets, I spoke to the lead author of the study, Dr. Carly Grimes, from the Institute of Physical Activity and Nutrition at Deakin University.
Blood pressure is really important in childhood. Often we do think of it as an adult problem, but really the effects start very early on in life. So what we do know is that children with higher blood pressure early on in life actually track with that blood pressure into adulthood. So this means that they're at greater risk of ending up with hypertension as an adult. And also when they have consistently higher blood pressure throughout their life, it is causing damage to our important organs like our kidney and our hearts over time. This can also cause problems later on when we're adults.
So you've done a study that's looked at salt intake in kids and the potential impact on blood pressure. Can you just talk us through how you did it? Because you've relied on salt excretion in the urine.
Yeah. So in this study, we were interested in looking at sodium and the relationship with blood pressure. And there is good evidence already really in children to show that if we lower sodium intake, we will get a reduction in blood pressure. But there's limited evidence in Australia in school children. And there's also limited evidence using really good measures of sodium. So in this study, we used a 24-hour urine sample, which is considered the most accurate and reliable measure. And that is because all of the sodium that children are eating each day, they actually excrete via their kidneys and out of the urine. We get about 95% of the sodium is captured. And you can imagine in children, if you're asking on them to remember what they ate yesterday, that's quite challenging. So this is a good method to really have an accurate measure of how much sodium they had on the previous day. So that was one of the strengths of the study. And then we wanted to look at how that was related to their blood pressure.
And what did you find?
So overall, with all of the children, we found there was no association between sodium intake and their blood pressure. But then what we did find is when we looked at the some groups separately, we found some important differences. So in girls, we found that those children that were eating higher amounts of sodium actually had higher systolic blood pressure. But we didn't see that effect in boys. And then we also found an effect for body weight. So it appears that the greater body weight you have, this makes you more sensitive to the effects of sodium. And so the children living with obesity had a higher increase in their blood pressure for the amount of sodium that they were eating.
So I know there are previous studies that have suggested that consuming a lot of salt in childhood can actually impact the blood pressure. Your study appears to suggest it might be a bit more nuanced, perhaps, and gender dependent, weight dependent. What's the takeaway though? Because are people now going to relax and go, oh, well, that means we don't have to do anything about salt in our child's diet? What's the takeaway, do you think?
Yeah, so I think it's important to note that this was it's a large study. We had over 700 children. It was a cross-sectional study though. So there are limitations with cause and effect in that. We haven't done a trial where we have lowered the amount of sodium and then looked at the effect on blood pressure, and we have that evidence already. But yes, certainly in this study, what we can see is that sodium and its effect on blood pressure is important for some groups. And the findings in girls are exploratory and they do need to be repeated. But I mean, there is emerging evidence in adults that females are more sensitive to the effects of salt. So we should be, you know, doing further research to understand if this might be happening earlier on in childhood. And certainly we do know that when you're carrying excess body weight, this will impact the kidney's ability to excrete sodium and also impact how blood pressure is regulated. So there are certain groups like those children living with excess weight that could really benefit from reducing sodium even more so.
So how do you do it, Carly? Is it just as simple as not putting salt into food when you're cooking, not having salt at the dinner table, or is it a bit more complicated than that?
So in this study, I think it's important to remember that 3/4 of children were exceeding the maximum limit for sodium for good health. So we do need to work on reducing sodium in all children. And how do we do it? So if we think about where most children are getting their sodium from, it's actually coming from salt, which is added to manufactured and processed foods. So the first step really is to eat more fresh fruits, like fresh fruits and vegetables, nuts and meats, because these are naturally low in sodium. Of course, we're going to eat some packaged foods as well. So when we're at the shop, what we can do is we can check the food label, turn it around to the back and look for sodium and pick a product that has less sodium per 100 grams in the product. In children, in this sample, bread, processed meats and cheese are the top 3 sources of sodium. So when parents are at the supermarket, check the bread, look for one with less than 400 milligrams of sodium. Check your cheese and look for one less than 700 milligrams of sodium. Avoid packaged slice cheese sticks, the really processed versions. And with the processed meat, try and avoid that. Don't put processed meat on a sandwich. A slice of ham alone can contribute to 1/4 of a child's daily sodium limit. So swap it out with things like hummus and cheese, grated carrot and avocado, egg and lettuce, unsalted nut butters. There are other different options that parents can experiment with there.
So reading food labels, though, should almost be second nature, like actually checking these processed things, which are part of life, bread, cheese, all of these things, but just trying to choose the lower salt option.
Exactly. And if you're going to focus in on 2 products, start with your bread and cheese. If you can't remember the numbers of how much you should be aiming for, just pick one with less, the one with less sodium per 100 grams.
I just want to pick up on something you said before, Carly, which is that in your study, 3/4 of the kids exceeded the recommendations when it came to salt intake. It might not be that it impacts blood pressure potentially. So maybe someone's eating too much salt, a child, their blood pressure's normal. Is it still potentially having other negative effects on their health?
Over time, so even though, you know, overall in these kids we found no association between sodium and blood pressure, over time, a long exposure to sodium over your lifetime may be increasing the stiffening of the arteries and slowly increasing that rise in blood pressure. So it's hard to sometimes really measure these effects over a long-term effect on the cardiovascular system. The other issue with the sodium is that we develop a preference for salt in our diet. Salt does make food taste a little bit better and can bring out flavours. And in kids, there is evidence to show that if they're having higher sodium intakes early on, that can contribute to the development of a preference for salt in foods, which we don't really want. We really want kids to be going through life getting to know foods that have less sodium from the start and having healthier taste preferences develop.
Dr. Carly Grimes from the Institute of Physical Activity and Nutrition at Deakin University.
You didn't ask about potties.
No,
Go back.
I'll get Carly back on. Everyone wants to know, how do you collect 24-hour urine from a child?
You're listening to The Health Report here on ABC Radio National. Priya, what feedback do you get from your patients about breast screening? Do they like it?
That's an interesting question.
That's why I asked it.
Yes. Do they like it? Well, I think if they're engaging in the screening process, yes, they think the benefits outweigh the risks.
But we've you and I, and you particularly, have been looking at some of the problems with breast screening when they find breast density and so on. So there's a bit of confusion around about it.
Yes, and I think it's a space where people really want a lot more information potentially.
Well, there's been a recent study which looks at whether or not you could relieve the burden, not that it's a huge burden, but the burden of screening from some women and intensify it in other women if you actually worked out what their risk was. So what this study did was they looked at various factors that are known to increase or decrease the risk of breast cancer, particularly genetic screening. What they did was if women scored high on their risk score, they got more intensive screening and they backed off on women who were low on the risk score. And what they found was that you could do less screening in some women and more in others, and you didn't miss any cancers in this randomized trial. So the question is, why don't we introduce risk-based screening more widely? We could probably save some money, and a lot of women wouldn't have to go for breast screening quite as often, and others would have their minds settled. So to talk about the policy and scientific issues here, I spoke to Professor Dorothy Keefe, who is CEO of Australia's cancer agency, which is called Cancer Australia.
Breast Screen Australia is a national program in which women from the ages of 50 to 74 are invited for a free mammogram every 2 years. Women aged 40 to 49 and women over 75 are also able to attend, but they're not actually invited separately by the program.
And that would still be a free mammogram?
Absolutely.
Every woman is different, and a screening program always averages things out. And there's this tantalizing notion that you could differentiate between women who need more screening versus less screening or different kinds of screening from genetic testing, from their breast density and other factors all put together in an algorithm. And there's been an interesting recent paper that suggests if you do that, you diagnose the same number of breast cancers, but there are some women who need far less intervention. What's Cancer Australia's view on that, and your personal view as a cancer researcher?
The thing about population screening is it was started in the days when we didn't know how to differentiate, but the program's been running for 30 years or so now. And so we've become more sophisticated. We've learned a lot more about what the risk factors for breast cancer are, how they work, how your genes play into it, how your age, et cetera, plays in. And so as the science has evolved, so this ability to perhaps tailor the screening has evolved. But of course, you don't want to miss cancers. And so you have to be very careful that what you're doing is actually enriching the population without excluding people who actually need to be tested.
We've heard anecdotally about clinicians who are already doing that for their patients, so saying, oh, I'm going to do this genetic test on you. I've got, you know, an algorithmic score based on your age, your breast density and so on, and already doing it. How close are we to knowing what a valid risk score for breast cancer is and how easy to administer?
I think we're getting close, but we're not actually there yet. And this study in America is very interesting because, as you say, it shows that you can diagnose the same number of cancers without putting so many people through so many investigations. But the problem is that that's a little bit difficult to transfer to Australia because in the US, they don't screen every woman anyway. And
well,
also,
we don't either. I mean, not every woman.
No, we don't. This is true. At least we offer it to all women here. But the other thing is that they screen every year, not every 2 years. And that does make a difference to the number of people who will have a negative test.
So that's because they're frightened about interval cancers, cancers that appear between screenings, and therefore the more often you do it, maybe it's less likely that you find an interval cancer.
That's absolutely true. The risk scores are coming because we're increasingly able to look at patients' genes, everything very minutely. But it's not an exact science and it's not quite ready for prime time yet. And in Australia, we are looking at it. The breast screen review that the government has just completed is looking at all of those things.
But it has to be said that the mammography screening program is not an exact science either, because there's this whole breast density issue, which we've covered and suggests that by telling women that they've got high breast density, it leaves them in a quandary about what to do. And the tests aren't covered by Medicare that you might want to follow up with, such as MRI and so on. We do have problems at the moment which are causing anxiety and could be actually increasing the risk of interval cancers.
So yes, women with denser breasts do have some issues with mammography because it's harder to see the cancers. That doesn't diminish the theory and practice of a mammographic screening program for the whole population, but it does absolutely support this idea that it's better to try and tailor the screening to the needs of the woman.
And while I've got you, then what about this issue that we identify now breast density and women know about it? If they want to pursue it, they've got to do it off their own account. Medicare won't actually fund it.
This is, again, a tricky issue, isn't it? Where the baseline screening test is without cost. The subsequent investigations and treatments feed into what the current rest of the health system is. So in some ways, we've accelerated a little bit faster than our ability to keep up with it. And I think that's going to be a moving area.
So what you're saying is we really do have to package up breast screening with diagnosis so that if a woman gets on the train, which is having her mammographic screening, what's then discovered is covered rather than being just an advantage for people who can afford to pay.
I mean, Norman, this is a much bigger conversation about screening and healthcare costs in general, because as you know, there are other screening programs where similar issues arise.
But for example, in cervical cancer, Medicare will cover a colposcopy and biopsy. You know, if you need a colonoscopy after a positive fecal occult blood test, you in theory can get one in the public system at no cost.
You can, although there is a very large waiting list in some areas for that now. So I think that what's happening is that we're getting more sophisticated in our science at the front end, and we have to run all those changes all the way through the whole system, and that takes time. We should be evolving our programs constantly to take account of the evolution in science and knowledge.
Professor Dorothy Keefe, who's an oncologist and CEO of Cancer Australia.
More nuanced screening. That's the dream. On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report.
So I'm really looking forward to this story, Priya, because I think a lot of people have now seen the four corners that Louise Milligan made a few weeks ago, which exposed rather poor, that's understating it, clinical practice in relation to women with endometriosis, over-treatment. I mean, go and look at it for yourself. But I think it's left a lot of women confused.
It has. I think there are a lot of people now questioning their management, feeling quite anxious. And so we thought it's the perfect time to actually speak to an expert about what diagnosis of a condition like endometriosis looks like, the potential management options, and kind of discuss this notion of chronic pelvic pain, because it's not always endometriosis. It might be, but there are other potential causes. We're hoping to clear things up in a very confusing time. Here's Dr. Niyash Agwata, who's a gynecologist and advanced laparoscopic surgeon in Melbourne.
Endometriosis is essentially endometrial-like tissue that is found in the lining of the endometrium. So that's the lining of your uterus. And we see it outside of the uterus. And because it's deemed as a multi-system disorder, it's because those endometrial-like tissue, you can see it anywhere in the body, essentially. We mainly see it in the pelvis, but it can go up as high as the diaphragm.
In terms of chronic pelvic pain, that might be due to endometriosis, but it could be due to something else. Can we just separate those two entities for a second, that not all people with this really chronic pelvic pain necessarily have endometriosis, and that not everyone with endometriosis necessarily has chronic pelvic pain?
Yeah, that is true. And it's really hard to sort of distinguish and, you know, differentiate the two, because there's is a lot of overlap, right? And so you do have a lot of people with endometriosis, and we know that they're different stages, right? You've got stage one, stage two, stage three, and stage four endometriosis. And the stage is really the extent of disease and how much, you know, other organs are involved. And so you have people with, say, stage four disease, which is the most severe type, where everything is stuck together, organs are stuck together, and they don't have chronic pelvic pain. They don't have pain at all. And then you have people with stage one disease, which is the most minimal type of disease, where you see, you know, spots of it in the pelvis or elsewhere, but they can have really debilitating pain. And so the disease doesn't correlate with the symptoms. And again, you can have people who have chronic pelvic pain and then not have any endometriosis. And so pain is very multifactorial, and there are a lot of reasons for pain.
Diagnosis of endometriosis, can you talk us through that? What does it look like for people? They might present to someone like their GP with pain. They might have heavy vaginal bleeding. They might have pain during sex. What does that diagnostic pathway, can you walk us through it?
Yeah, so I think the diagnostic pathway is sort of changing now because we're moving towards more of a clinical diagnosis of endometriosis. So like what you said, the typical symptoms of painful periods, heavy periods, pain with sex, pain when opening your bowels, especially during your period, cyclical pelvic pain, so pain with your cycle, but also pain outside of your cycle. Those symptoms together can make that diagnosis of endometriosis without an ultrasound that shows endometriosis. And so, you know, I think we are moving away from the gold standard being a laparoscopy, so being an operation to look for endometriosis, and moving more towards a clinical diagnosis to try and, stop the delay of treatment.
What about ultrasound? So some people, it might be really clear from potentially the history. Does everyone need confirmation of either an ultrasound or a laparoscopy to really firm up the diagnosis? Or could you really say this is endometriosis without anything else?
Look, I think, you know, an ultrasound is a really good tool to give us more information about the disease. So we know that there are limitations to ultrasound, and we also know that not all ultrasounds are the same. And so there are specialized people who, you know, have done 6 years of obstetrics and gynae training and then have gone on to do a further 2-3 years of just gynecological ultrasound training to look for endometriosis. And so we call these COGU scans, and they're really good at picking up disease, looking at stage 3 and stage 4 endometriosis particularly, and are really getting better at picking up stage 1 and stage 2 disease as well. I think a scan is really the starting point to helping with the diagnosis of endometriosis. But like you said, there are limitations to the scan as well.
And you're saying that these people, this might not be in every ultrasound center, this dual trained individual.
Yeah.
So when you say this is a specialized scan,
It
might cost more.
Yeah.
It might not be widely available. Is that fair?
There are definitely not that many around the country, and majority of centres are not specialised endometriosis centres that do specialised ultrasounds. So, yeah, you are correct.
Where does laparoscopy fit in? And we're talking about, of course, surgery where there are ports inserted, there is a camera, you can take biopsies to be tested. Where does that fit in? Who is it for?
Mm-hmm.
And what are the kind of the steps that go into potentially considering that?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. I think the patients that who is for, it's really a joint decision making together with the patient that you're treating, whether it is confirmed on an ultrasound already or not confirmed. It's a discussion to have with your patients as to whether or not a laparoscopy is going to, number one, give you answers, or number two, treat the disease and give you relief from the pain. We know the guidelines have shown that medical management is a really good first line management.
And so what do you mean by that? What do you mean by medical management?
Yeah, so medical management being hormonal treatments to try and stop the burden of the disease and also try and treat endometriosis related type pain. And so we know that, you know, oral contraceptive pills are a really good first line. Not one pill is superior to another. And so it's a matter of working out which pill is the right pill for the right patient.
So for some people, medical management might be really quite effective at managing pain and bleeding. And then how does the decision get to potentially laparoscopy then?
So in situations where medical management has failed and it's not helping in terms of symptoms and treatment of those symptoms. But also we have to realize that this population of people who have endometriosis, they have probably been gaslit for many, many years. They spent many years going from one specialist to the another. Usually it's a gastroenterologist, somebody else, to be told that, no, this is not, you know, your pain is not due to this, your pain is not due to that. And so they sort of at the end of their tether, and then they come with a normal looking, normal quote unquote, pelvic ultrasound, and then still don't have answers for that. So there is a subset of population where having that answer is so freeing, as well as, you know, confirms to them that it's not in their head and that this pain, you know, is coming from the endometriosis itself. And I think that's really, really important to validate patients who have gone through that journey. So that's a tool where I think it's appropriate.
Diagnostically, so you go into the pelvis, you might take biopsies, and the intention there is to confirm that there's this endometrial-like tissue growing outside of the uterus, the womb?
Yeah, that's correct. So when you go in with a laparoscopy, what you want to do is do a full, what we call surveillance of the whole pelvis. So when we go in, we're able to see everything from the diaphragm all the way down to the pelvis. And so you want to do a really, really good look, take lots and lots of pictures, and then anything that looks obvious like endometriosis or you suspect to be endometriosis to remove.
I just wonder, because we've acknowledged that chronic pelvic pain, whether it's due to endometriosis or not, can be really quite a complex, multifaceted thing.
Mm.
If someone has endometriosis with pain, is surgery, laparoscopy, removal of the tissue, where is that the kind of cornerstone of management, or is that a part of it? Is it meant to be done repeatedly?
Yeah, so with endometriosis, you really, really want to manage it in a multidisciplinary fashion, right? And so medication is one component of the management. Surgery is one component of the management, but you really need to get a full team involved. Usually it looks like a pelvic floor physiotherapist, a dietitian. Sometimes you need a pain specialist involved. And, you know, in a center of excellence, having a endometriosis nurse as well is really, really important to support endometriosis patients in their journey. So surgery really is just one component of the management, and it needs to be surrounded by everything else, because this is a long-term disease. It's a chronic disease, and we know that it does come back.
If someone has a laparoscopy and removal of the tissue, does it necessarily equate to no pain, resolution of pain?
That's such an important conversation to have when you are embarking on surgery, because it may or may not fix the pain, and it may temporarily fix the pain, and then the pain does come back. And so you can never guarantee that you can completely fix somebody's pain. And in medicine, you can never completely guarantee anything, right? Because there's so many other factors and outliers, and we don't know everything in medicine. So you really have to go in with realistic expectations that yes, you can see pathology, yes, you can see disease, yes, you can remove it. And people do feel better, you know, after endometriosis excision surgery, and do feel better for long periods of time. But we don't know which population of people are going to feel better for 10, 15 years, and which population of people this endometriosis is going to go back. So we can never guarantee that you will be pain-free. But again, it's part of the management plan where you're making that decision together to try and improve pain.
At the moment, I think the figure in Australia is women wait on average 6 to 8 years for an endometriosis diagnosis. And I think people are very aware of things that have happened in their newsfeed recently. Do you think this hurts this kind of gains that we've seen in women's health recently? Have we seen progress, and do you think it's potentially been hurt recently?
No, I think we're really seeing progress. I think people are talking about it more, and people are understanding that pain that debilitates you, that you can't, you know, do your normal activities, it's not normal, and it needs to be investigated. So look, I think there's a lot of talk out, you know, in the media and everywhere else, but I think as a community of people who do have endo, their voices are a lot stronger. And I think, you know, educating other people as well is super, super important. So I think we're doing better than we were before, to be honest.
You talk about making the decision together, this kind of shared decision making with between the clinician and the patient. Mm. What kinds of things should the patient be asking of the gynecologist when you're going through the options for treatment?
Oh, yes. If you're talking about medical management and you're talking about medicines, you'll be like, what are the medications that are available? What is the decision making behind starting this medication versus this medication? What are the side effects? What are the things that I should look for? How long do we need to try this medication before we decide that this is the right medication or not the right medication? And then when it comes to surgery, you know, I think patients are becoming a lot more empowered to be asking, you know, do you do the surgery often? Are you experienced in the surgery? How many times have you done this? What are your complication rates? You're having that discussion about what you're going to do when you are in surgery. And so you need to be on the same page about that.
And people can always get a second opinion, can't they?
100%.
How do people do that? Can you just talk us through? Because I think a lot of people at the moment might be going, oh, I just want to double check that I'm on the right pathway.
Yeah.
How do people do it?
If you feel like you need a second opinion, you don't even need to tell them that you're having a second opinion, or you can just pause and be like, sure, you know what? I'll get back to you on that one and then go seek a second opinion elsewhere. Even if you are, you know, have signed a consent for surgery, have decided that you're going to embark on it, you can decline up until the day of surgery. So even if you've filled in paperwork and stuff, you can still go and get a second opinion elsewhere. You need to trust your healthcare provider, number one. And if something doesn't feel right, then you need to ask those questions. And if you feel that those questions have not been answered, then go seek the answers elsewhere and get a second opinion.
Dr. Niasha Gwata, who's a gynecologist and advanced laparoscopic surgeon.
You're listening to The Health Report on ABC Radio National. So what's in the mailbag?
We've had Laura write in, and Laura says, "Hi there, you were talking recently about the success of self-testing pap smears. And this was a story that we did on self-collection for cervical cancer screening and how effective it was in actually increasing the rates of screening, particularly in those women who are underscreened. But Laura writes, my pelvic physiotherapist said that one drawback of self-testing is that many women's vulvas are now going unexamined, possibly for years."
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
"This could give diseases such as lichen sclerosis time to advance unnoticed until significant damage is caused." So lichen sclerosis is a condition that can impact the vulva. It can actually cause whitish discoloration. It can be very itchy and uncomfortable. And over time, it can actually increase the risk of skin cancers in the area because of all the chronic inflammatory changes to the skin. So it can be quite serious and difficult to treat with high-dose steroids.
Which is Laura's point. Perhaps this will be missed.
Yes. And Laura says this could have awful consequences, as untreated lichen sclerosis can cause cancer too, something for the medical profession to consider perhaps. My comment to that would be...
What would it be? Tell us, Priya.
Well, I have patients who have had a really traumatic experience in their lifetime, or it's a really big social or cultural barrier and they were never going to get screened, whereas self-collection has actually allowed them to screen for cervical cancer.
So nobody was going to look anyway.
Yes. And I think for some people who are so deeply uncomfortable and underscreened, I think self-collection has changed the game. And if people are going to get tested for one cancer when they weren't going to do it at all, I think that's still a win.
Thank you, Laura, for that. And we've got an anonymous email on our segment on gout and asking, have you ever discussed pseudogout? It would be good to be able to learn more about this problem, which has attacked my wrist. Not your knee, I know name, but your wrist. I'm glad it's just the wrist. Okay.
Is that you writing in? Because you do love talking about joints.
I don't think I've got pseudogout. Well, here's your second tutorial, your second examination question. Tell us about pseudogout.
I feel like I'm in an exam today.
You are.
So pseudogout is, it's calcium crystals. It is a different entity. It can impact different joints. It's often one of, I think it's kind of a diagnostic dilemma sometimes. I forget to think about it and then it crops into my mind a little bit later. But my husband recently had a patient with some unusual joint pain and he did a joint aspirate and it was pseudogout. So we were just talking about this the other day.
Gosh.
That's how nerdy we are.
Yeah.
But we could do a whole thing on it, Norman. That could be, I think everyone wants Norman to cover another joint issue.
Yeah. I think that's what's going on in my knee. I don't think so.
It could be.
It's been a long time. Anyway, I'm not going to talk about joints as much as I like to. And Gordon writes in, Norman, you recently mentioned that tooth enamel is softened after a while after eating. How long should I wait before cleaning my teeth? Good question, Gordon.
And Gordon, can we also add Gordon has written a nice line to us that the producer has cut out. We do like to read out. Can you read out the nice bit too?
Yeah, so... James, our producer, has cut out. Thanks for the informative shows and thanks to each person involved in getting them to us. There you go.
We keep them in, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. We like your compliments. Look, I think it's an hour or two after eating is what the dentists say. I mean, and whether or not it's true, I mean, I'm sounding as if I'm a dentist. Look, what I know about oral health can be written on the back of a molar. So just, Gordon,
me too.
Take it with a pinch of enamel, okay?
Don't believe everything you hear out of Norman's. Like, honestly, I was thinking, are you also a dentist that I don't know
about? You're making me anxious, Gordon, because I didn't actually wash my teeth before I came into the studio.
Yes.
So if my performance today has been poor, it's because I didn't wash my teeth.
And people should know that Norman, when I first met him, told me that any time he goes into a studio, you brush your teeth.
No, well, I brush my teeth. That wasn't putting
yes.
on you.
No, you weren't asking me to. But please.
I don't force this on anybody else.
We want you to write in. And if you have comments about Norman's toothbrushing, tell us. Our address is healthreport@abc.net.au.
And don't forget our sister podcast, Where My Teeth Are Always Spotless, What's That Rash? Where this week we're talking about vitamin C.
Eat an orange, I reckon.
Yeah.
Or a lemon.
But don't heat it up because that's really bad for your teeth.
Oh.
Yeah, hot.
Okay. Oh, we're going back to the teeth. Okay.
Hot citrus, poison.
On that note, I'll see you next week.
Don't know what it's like with honey. Yeah, I'll see you next week.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.